Lecture 24. The British East India Company.
Between 1757 and 1857, the English East India Company went from being mainly a commercial corporation to seizing direct or indirect control over all of India, totaling roughly 1.5 million square miles. On average, that meant about 15,000 square miles were conquered every year. This made it bigger than any other empire in all of India's history. It was also an area about as large as Western Europe. Plus, India had a substantially larger population, at least 270 million people around 1800. This empire building was even more striking since there were only a few thousand British officials and officers at any one time in India. India, unlike North America or Australia, was never a white settler colony, so the history of its relationship to Britain was quite different. In this lecture, we'll survey the major ways that various Britons and Indians interacted over this first century of expanding British colonial rule. The immediate effects and long-term consequences of these processes were profound for India, Britain, and the world. During this century, there were many competing interests in Britain and in India, with the balance among them changing over time. In London, most of the East India Company's stockholders sought profits with a minimum of expenses on risky ventures like war. Many members of Parliament also believed that it was against British interests and morality to conquer an empire in Asia. But there were also politicians who wanted to increase British power in the world, especially against competing European countries like the French. By the mid-19th century, British imperialists had largely come to prevail over those British politicians who counseled restraint. In India as well, there were deep political differences. The young British men who ventured to India as East India Company employees risked their lives. Many died in shipwrecks or from disease or in the growing warfare in India. So they wanted rapid rewards, more than just their modest salaries. Some, like Robert Clive, went out to India as clerks, but preferred glory and profit from war. Clive discovered that he had a special genius for commanding troops in battle and for negotiating with Indian rulers. Various classes of Indians also competed with each other, each developing different relationships with the British that changed over time. Growing numbers of artisans, servants, and soldiers found employment with Europeans. Some thriving Indian merchants and financiers developed mutually profitable arrangements with the English company from early after its arrival. These classes sometimes sided with the British against often repressive Indian rulers. The diverse Indian rulers and warlords competing for power alternately regarded Europeans as potential sources for plunder, or else allies whose armies they could rent. By the late 18th century, weak Mughal emperors still nominally reigned over most of India, but they were really prisoners of one or another regent. Instead, most parts of India were either under regionally based kings or else Mughal successor states. For example, in 1756, Siraj-ud-Daulah, at age 23, inherited his grandfather's position as Nawab, or Mughal governor, over the rich province of Bengal. But he was effectively an independent king. One of his first acts was to attack the English East India Company's outpost in Calcutta. He seized money and goods, driving off many of the hapless Britons. His men imprisoned others in the infamous Black Hole of Calcutta. Now, while this incident became a rallying cry for many Britons thereafter, rumors greatly exaggerated the number of British prisoners who died. But Robert Clive rushed by sea from Madras, bringing with him Indian mercenary soldiers known as sepoys. They quickly recovered Calcutta. Clive then marched his forces, totaling about 800 Europeans and 2,200 sepoys, against Nawab Siraj-ud-Daulah's army of about 50,000 men, which was 16 times larger. Clive, however, bribed one of the opposing generals, Mir Jafar, promising to make him the new Nawab of Bengal if he would betray his master and also pay up to 20 million rupees, which was a vast amount of money. Part of the money went to the East India Company, but much also went to Clive personally. The company also demanded and received a trade monopoly over some of the most profitable and prestigious products in the region. So the famous June 23, 1757 Battle of Plassey was really more bribery than actual fighting. Mir Jafar then hunted down and executed the defeated Nawab. The East India Company's officials in India had thus suddenly seized vast power and wealth. In fact, after Plassey, the English East India Company controlled an area three times the size of England and far more densely populated. Further, when Mir Jafar could not fulfill his promises, the English removed him, enthroning his son-in-law instead. But that new ruler soon turned against the English, so they put Mir Jafar back on the throne again. This was a developing policy of indirect rule, that is, the company controlled territory through subordinated Indian rulers. Additionally, the company collected and kept most of the tax money from Bengal. From this point onward, the East India Company was able to take enough from its trade monopolies and the taxes it collected from Bengal so that it could purchase all the Indian products it wanted and still ship home additional gold and silver. For the first time in history, India, not Europe, had a trade deficit. But Clive and many other Englishmen believed that a commercial corporation like the East India Company should not be a ruler. In 1759, just 2 years after Plassey, Clive wrote to the most influential British minister, William Pitt the Elder, Earl of Chatham, saying, quote, "So large a sovereignty is too extensive for a mercantile company, and it is to be feared that they are not of themselves able, without the nation's assistance, to maintain so wide a dominion." Close quote. Clive pleaded in the strongest terms that the British government rule over this captured land. He also proposed that the English send a couple of thousand Royal Army soldiers who would conquer more land and drive the French out of India. Additionally, Indian sepoys could be cheaply hired to do much of the actual fighting. If the British government did not use this opportunity, Clive feared, the French would. Clive promised that India would be a profitable colony, unlike North America, which was currently driving the British government into debt. Clive also assured Pitt that the Indian people would prefer British colonial rule to the so-called Oriental despotism they suffered under Indian rulers. Of course, Clive did not actually ask Indians if this was true. But Pitt rejected Clive's pleas. As I mentioned earlier, many British politicians at this time believed that it was morally corrupting for the English crown to have a land empire in Asia. They felt that continental European powers might have empires that ruled over foreign peoples, but the English should not. But this did not prevent other British officials in India from continuing their military assertions. In 1764-65, the East India Company's sepoy army twice defeated the current Mughal emperor, Shah Alam II, and his supporters. The emperor became a palace prisoner of the English, and he officially granted them the office of tax collector for Greater Bengal. In fact, English officials had already been collecting and keeping those taxes for years. The company continued legally to hold this office as a nominal imperial official for nearly 90 years, until it deposed the last Mughal emperor. While British men in India like Clive sought personal fame and gained much wealth by seizing territory in India, most of the British government and the company's directors in London opposed these costly wars and imperious annexations. Money that Robert Clive took from India made him one of the wealthiest men in England and a baron. But in 1772-73, Parliament launched a probing investigation of Clive for corruption, both financial and moral. Although he was not convicted, he died a year later at age 49 from either suicide or a heart attack. These debates about British imperialism continued in London for decades. Pitt's son, William Pitt the Younger, passed the 1784 India Act, which forbade exactly what Clive had requested. This act asserted that, quote, "To pursue schemes of conquest and extension of dominion in India are measures repugnant to the wish, the honor, and the policy of this nation. It shall not be lawful for company officials in India either to declare war or commence hostilities or enter into any treaty for making war against any of the princes or states in India," close quote. In order to rein the company in, Parliament also created a board of control to supervise it. Despite this, British officials in India continued to launch wars and seize lands. Since the East India Company already controlled India's richest province, Bengal, it could afford to hire and equip more Indian sepoys than any rival Indian powers. The British scholar Anthony Lowe termed this sub-imperialism. That is, Europeans on the colonial frontier start wars and annex territories, often without the approval of their government in Europe. The British government might try to punish these sub-imperialist officials, but it did not give back the land they had seized. This produced a step-like series of annexations, with big increases in annexations followed by periods of none. In order to coordinate all the company's policies in India, in 1772, the directors appointed a governor general. In those days of slow communication by sailing ship, it might take 6 months for orders from London to reach India, if they arrived at all, and another 6 months for the reply to return. So each governor general largely devised and implemented his own ideas about how to run India. The first governor general, Warren Hastings, who held office from 1772 to 85, recognized the value and utility of some Indian men and traditions. He had spent most of his career in India, arriving around 18. He then worked his way up through the company's administration in Bengal. Governor General Hastings employed many Indians as officials, including as judges and administrators. He sponsored the study and codification of Indian laws using Sanskrit language texts for Hindus and Persian and Arabic texts for Muslims. Indeed, even today, there are separate civil law codes for Hindus and Muslims in independent India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Hastings also paid Indian scholars to search through long neglected libraries, recovering decaying manuscripts that would otherwise have been lost. These were then translated into English, where they received a new life. Such British scholars discovered that Sanskrit and other North Indian languages came from the same Indo-European mother tongue as English and almost all other European languages. Now, Hastings' policies were known at that time as Orientalist, meaning that they valued Asian knowledge. But Hastings was simultaneously acting as a paternal and self-appointed preserver of Indian traditions. Now, following the work of Palestinian scholar Edward Said, many recent commentators have criticized Orientalism as the appropriation by the West of Asian knowledge. That is, Europeans and Americans asserting that they knew more about the East than did people from those Eastern cultures. Hastings also imposed British power onto nearby Indian kingdoms. He personally led military expeditions that punished resisting Indian rulers. He annexed their territories and made himself personally rich. But this eventually provided his political opponents in London with much evidence against him. On his return to England, the British House of Commons impeached him for corruption. He went on trial before the House of Lords in 1787. He was not acquitted for nearly a decade. Again, sub-imperialism had been disavowed by London. To replace Hastings as Governor General, the British government sent a very different type of man, Charles Marquis of Cornwallis. He came from a landed aristocracy, and he was a career official in the British Royal Army. He's best known in America for surrendering at Yorktown in 1781 to George Washington and his French allies. Despite this setback, Cornwallis retained much political influence in London. He was appointed Governor General in 1786, just 5 years after his Yorktown surrender. In India, Cornwallis tried to impose on the company's administration some of the theories he brought with him. He knew virtually nothing about India before he arrived, but he distrusted Indians, claiming, quote, "Every native of India, I verily believe, is corrupt," close quote. So he appointed British men to all important offices. This meant that many Indians with long service traditions to earlier rulers and even to the East India Company lost their jobs or were subordinated to less experienced white British officials. Coming from an English landed elite, Cornwallis also believed strongly in the value of land ownership. This followed the then influential French physiocrat school of economics. The central idea here was that agricultural land grounded every sound economy. Mere manufacturing, banking, and commerce were all dependent on that agricultural base. Physiocrats said, if you burn down cities but have a strong agriculture, the cities will recover. But if you destroy agriculture, then cities will die. So Cornwallis went to India determined to impose this physiocrat economic system on Bengal, even though he knew nothing about it before he arrived. He intended to establish a network of Indian landlords, like the landed gentry and squires of England, who would tend the land, improve agricultural production, and thereby advance the whole Indian economy. In 1793, he recognized legal ownership rights by a class of Indians known as zamindars, or landholders. They could now buy and sell their lands as their personal property. As an incentive to invest in improving the land, Cornwallis ordered that the land tax would never be raised. This was the permanent settlement, since taxes due were settled permanently. However, if any land owner failed to pay his taxes exactly when they were due, his lands would be auctioned off by the British. But the Indian economy and system of land holding did not work the way that Cornwallis assumed. So his permanent settlement produced unintended effects. Indian zamindars historically did have some specific rights over particular lands, with the main one being the right to collect taxes for the government and keep a share of it. But other people also had rights to that same land, including the farmers who actually did the field work, plus temples and village officials who also received a share of the taxes. So when the zamindars were legally transformed from landholders into landlords, those other people lost out. Many farmers became tenants, whom the landlord could now legally expel. In addition, many zamindars were used to negotiating with the earlier Mughal government about how much they actually had to pay in taxes. So they were shocked when they lost their land just because they did not pay their whole tax exactly on time. This meant that many estates were auctioned off, and the urban-based rich Indian merchants purchased many of them. Many of these Indian merchants had profited greatly from working with or for the British. They also understood how the British and capitalism operated. By purchasing landed estates, these Indian merchants gained prestige in Indian and British eyes. But instead of investing their profits back into the land for its improvement, these new land owners often chose to live in Calcutta. In rural areas, a new class of intermediate overseers arose, often brutally squeezing as much rent from tenant farmers as they could and passing that money on to the absentee land owner. So Cornwallis's plan backfired. Later governors general abandoned his physiocratic ideas, although they could not legally change the 1793 permanent settlement. Instead, each new governor general tried to impose his own abstract theories about the economy and the best way to govern India. But like Cornwallis, they often had little knowledge of actual conditions in India before they arrived there. Additionally, many governors general sought glory for themselves through sub-imperialist wars. They often justified their wars by claiming instability and misgovernment in nearby Indian kingdoms that might, they claimed, spread to the company's lands. So to achieve a stable and secure frontier, the company's armies should invade and annex them. One of the more aggressive governors general was Lord Richard Wellesley, elder brother to the later Duke of Wellington. He wrote in 1801, quote, "The right of the company to secure the British interests must be considered as the fundamental principle of every arrangement," close quote. Wellesley's generals defeated the ruler of Mysore, Tipu Sultan, killing him in 1799, annexing some of that kingdom and setting up a puppet governor over the rest. In 1801, Wellesley annexed half of the kingdom of the company's longest subordinate ally, Aodh. Wellesley also defeated the Maratha Confederacy and made the Mughal emperor a palace prisoner, taking much of the Maratha's lands. But London kept scolding him for these wars and annexations, and Wellesley had to resign in 1805. Now, how did all this British imperialism look from the receiving end? The population of India was, of course, very diverse, with many different competing classes, communities, and interest groups. Many regional rulers fought battles against the British, but few won wars since they could not afford to equip and pay such large sepoy armies. Also, they could not match British control over the sea that enabled rapid redeployment around the Indian Peninsula under the coordination of the Governor General. Instead, the many different Indian rulers acted in their own individual interests, often fighting against each other. Most surviving rulers believed that they could do better by cooperating, or seeming to cooperate, with the English company than by openly opposing it. Many tried to use the company's armies against other Indian rulers, leaving it holding the balance of power. Some rented parts of the company's armies under the subsidiary alliance system. This kept the ruler personally safe from rebellions within his state, but it also meant that the company profited from the subsidies and could also use that force against the ruler if the company chose to do so. So a ruler had to decide among paying the company and staying on the throne, fighting against it and probably losing everything, or surrendering, in which case he might receive a big pension but lose his throne. Beyond rulers, many other classes and groups of Indians also acted in various ways in the face of expanding British imperialism. Some Indians refused to cooperate with the East India Company. But as its wealth and power expanded, these groups tended to lose out to others that found a way to gain from it. For example, there were substantial classes of officials who did much of the actual administration before the company took over. Some of these people remained loyal to their Indian rulers and so faded from power along with them. Other traditional service elites learned how to adapt to the British. They continued to collect taxes, keep records, and make the legal system function, except now there were white British officers commanding them. Out of the interactions among these various Indians and Britons emerged hybrid systems of government. Often, the British anglicized customary Indian procedures and laws, which altered them. But conversely, many Indians Indianized British procedures and laws. We can see some of these processes in the career of one of the most remarkable men of his day, Ram Mohan Roy. He came from a family of Brahmins who had served in pre-British administrations. Then they gained enough capital by working for the British to acquire land ownership rights under the permanent settlement. But this family realized that its sons needed to learn about the British in order to continue to prosper. So they educated Ram Mohan Roy in English as well as the Persian and Arabic of the pre-British administration, plus the Bengali language spoken in the region, and also the Sanskrit of the Hindu sacred texts. By age 22, he had mastered all five of these languages. Later, he learned Latin and Greek so he could read Christian sacred texts in those languages. For a decade, between 1804 and 1814, Ram Mohan Roy himself worked as an official in the British administration in Bengal, seeing how the British functioned from within the system. Then he retired at age 42 in order to devote himself to improving his own community. He led like-minded Indians in the Bengal Renaissance, a cultural movement based in Calcutta that strove to modernize Hindu society. In 1828, Ram Mohan started reforming Hinduism through a movement called the Brahmo Samaj. He found in the ancient Hindu scriptures the model of a monotheistic and formless creator god, Brahma, that they could worship. This answered Christian criticisms of Hinduism as polytheistic. In addition, Ram Mohan began the first newspapers run by an Indian, with articles in Persian, Bengali, and English, so it would reach a broad audience. He spent 3 years in London, where Unitarians and other progressive Britons listened to his words about how India should be governed, as well as about the universal nature of God. Ram Mohan wrote many articles, pamphlets, and books that engaged with the most important topics of the day. For example, he put pressure on the government to outlaw the practice of sati, where a Hindu widow proved her faithfulness to her late husband by killing herself, either on his funeral pyre or later. Some conservative Brahmins in Calcutta argued that this right should not be taken away from these widows, since it showed their Hindu wifely devotion and moral purity. But Ram Mohan argued that this act of concremation was often forced on these widows by their families. Women should be given the education and human rights that would enable them to live as respected widows or to remarry. The Governor General of that time, Lord William Bentinck, accepted Ram Mohan Roy's advice and that of British missionaries and some officials, and ordered sati outlawed in 1829. By looking at Bentinck's policies, we can see how different each governor general was. Bentinck followed the utilitarian political philosophy advanced by Jeremy Bentham. This philosophy argued that whatever served the greatest good for the greatest number of people should be government policy. In order to make the administration of India as efficient as possible, Bentinck reduced its expenses, including reducing the salary of British officials. As you can imagine, they resented his economies. He hired more Indian officials since he could pay them less salary than British men. In order to increase the government's income, Bentinck declared that all opium grown in British India had to be sold to the company at prices it set. This opium monopoly meant large profits when the company auctioned off that opium to British, Indian, and American merchants who then smuggled it into China to the growing millions of addicts there. This trade began only at about 500,000 pounds of opium in 1820, but rose to 13.4 million pounds of opium annually by 1880. When the Chinese imperial government tried to stop this illegal smuggling, the British Navy twice defeated it in the Opium Wars of 1839-42 and 1856-60, with the British colony of Hong Kong as one result. Governor General Bentinck also strongly believed in technological progress, encouraging steam navigation on the Ganges River, steam being the cutting-edge technology of his day. Bentinck abolished flogging in the East India Company's army, even though such whipping as punishment continued for the British Army for decades. But Bentinck's administration also imposed the Anglicization of the government's education system for Indians. There had long been debates between Anglicists and Orientalists. Anglicists argued that English was the language of science and progress, so Indians should have to be taught in it. Orientalists believed that Indians should be educated in their own languages. Now, by education, both sides really meant the education of a few Indian male elites, not mass education. In 1835, under Bentinck, the balance tilted in favor of the Anglicists. As Lord Macaulay's Minute on Indian Education stated, the goal was to, quote, form a class of elite Indians who may be the interpreters between us and the millions whom we govern. A class of persons Indian in blood and color, but English in tastes, in opinions, in morals, and in intellect." Close quote. In many ways, this educational policy is continued, as is shown in the systems currently in place in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Overall, during this century of East India Company expansion, while many Indians lost out, others adjusted and survived, or even prospered. With no pervasive sense of being part of an Indian nation, such employment did not seem traitorous, but rather the best option then available. But gradually, as the company's government and the British economy gained power, many more Indians suffered. For example, raw cotton grown in India went to British cloth mills, with the finished products sold back to Indians. This put most of the profit into British hands, while most Indian weavers were unemployed. Britons made ever more confident assertions that their religion and culture, and even their race, was superior to Indians. Indian sepoys felt undervalued, and Indian rulers were deposed. So British economic, cultural, and political assertions increasingly clashed with Indian interests. In the next lecture, we'll look at the tumult that erupted across North India in 1857 as a result of these tensions and conflicts.